Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. This podcast is brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. Episode 8 is about all things to do with labour pains. I'm one of your co-hosts, I'm Owen Thor, I'm an anaesthetic registrar, and joining me and Rosie today is Damien Hughes, who is not only a fantastic obstetric anaesthetics consultant, he is also an OAA exec committee member, and he has a special interest in remifentanil, which we'll hear about later. What have we got on the menu for you today? Well, we're going to go through the physiology of the pain of labour, then we're going to go through what is on offer for women on labour wards to deal with discomfort and pain. We'll then get onto our bread and butter of epidurals, followed by some discussion on remifentanil. We'll finish off the conversation with troubleshooting not only epidurals, but pain during cesarean section as well. Due to the location of the recording of this episode, some of the audio content is slightly different to normal, and you can hear some sirens, so we apologise for that. During the episode, we refer to a cheese ball, which was an analogy I used for placing an epidural and the ligaments you encounter, but I'll put that content into the outro. As ever, there are some links in bio. From the first time I met Damien, I could tell he'd be a great guest on the podcast, and he didn't disappoint. I really did enjoy editing this episode. I really hope you enjoy it as well. Welcome back to the NovPod. This is episode 8, if we haven't invented it anymore. And this one's about labour pains, or the pain during labour. I'm one of your co-hosts, I'm Owen Dorr. I'm an anaesthetic trainee in Thames Valley. Rosie, how would you like to identify yourself?
My name's Rosie. I'm an anaesthetic trainee with a special interest in obstetrics.
And we have a fantastic expert on labour analgesia.
I suspect I'm not an expert in very much, but I would describe myself as a jobbing anaesthetist in a busy DGH with a decent-sized obstetric unit. And for my sins and possibly a bit of a privilege, I'm also a member of the OAA, National Executive Committee. I have to say that and shout out that everybody should join the OAA. It's a wonderful organisation, but certainly I have a passion for trying to provide quality anaesthesia care for women. And I'm delighted to be invited here today to have a chat about exactly that.
And despite what you've just said in the intro, you actually are a subject matter expert, because I believe you've invented the remifentanil guidelines, or invented remifentanil.
I'll be stretching it. Currently, as you know, NICE guidance has actually big up the idea that you should consider provision of remifentanil for labour pain. And on that basis, in the OAA, I'm working with a few other really, really good colleagues who are real experts in the field, and we're going to produce some guidance, and that will hopefully come out next year.
We will set our Microsoft Teams calendars, Instagram accounts to that.
It's like a new thing on Netflix, yeah.
Damien, not to sound unsympathetic with the sympathetic nervous system, or maybe empathetic or compassionate, I'm not sure. But anyway, not to sound like the worst person of all time, but why should we care about the pain of women in labour? It's nice to provide a good experience, but does it actually matter, us going and sorting this out?
It matters on many, many levels. I couldn't possibly sit as an obstetric anaesthetist and say it didn't matter. I think the baseline is, if a woman wants pain relief for a known painful experience, that there is an analgesic management we can do. And I think it's beholden on us. It's like your laparotomy, not giving them their PCA post-op or whatever. So there's nothing wrong with simply giving it as a proper humanitarian analgesic regimen to any woman who wishes to have it. And it's one of the reasons why actually I don't really believe in this whole thing about it's too early to have your epidural. I mean, I think if a woman just wants the pain relief and epidural is what she's chosen, you just give it when she wants.
Yeah.
The evidence that it impacts at all on how they have their baby later on, how they labour and how successful a spontaneous vaginal birth will be for them is very, very poor. And in fact, most now would say that it really has minimal to no impact whatsoever. So let them have the pain relief that they want. But there are particular situations where if there are problems, either maternal problems, so she has comorbidities herself, or there are problems related to this pregnancy, we're actually doing something like an epidural is physiologically. Sorry, I'm bringing in physiology.
Oh, no, we love it.
I'm also a grammar freak, so I like awful things. But there's good physiological reasons why, for example, a lady with high blood pressure related to pregnancy, so that condition called preeclampsia, that is absolutely beneficially affected by having regional analgesia for labour. Two reasons. One is that, whereas an epidural, it actually drops the blood pressure a little bit, and that's really, really helpful to her. And then also, because it gives really good pain relief, it means she doesn't get the surges of blood pressure with the contractions. So you actually are very, very much medically protecting her. Never mind just being a good human being and a good anaesthetist and giving her pain relief.
And am I correct saying that there is some evidence for those women that they have better outcomes if they have epidurals?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the same, for example, if women have a cardiovascular disease where you can just make the sympathetic surges of labour much, much less. It means that also if they are comfortable and you don't want them pushing heavily at second stage of labour, and that's one really big outcome, that you can then allow the fetal head to descend because they're comfortable, and you can then actually do even an assisted birth in the labour room nicely for that woman without all of that pushing at second stage, which might be detrimental to her in a way that it might not be to other women. So there are very, very sound reasons why some women will benefit particularly from epidural analgesia in labour. But I would have as my baseline, it's just their right to have good pain relief full stop without any other particular reason.
Would you be able to just give us a brief run through for what are we actually looking at in terms of the physiology of the pain during labour?
Well, first and foremost, one of the things about anyone working in labour ward is that no situation is the same as the last one you ever saw. So the pain of labour is a very, very individual experience. It's different for every woman. And when you walk into the room to speak with that woman about her analgesic options, you need to be aware of that. It's about what matters to her. It's what her experience is. And on the basis of what you hear back, then you provide a menu of options that you can provide for that woman for pain in labour. Most women will experience significant pain in labour.
Yeah.
Not all women, but most women do. It is different in the earlier part of labour versus the later part. So I'm no obstetric expert. But for me, the first stage of labour is that earlier part where women are having regular uterine contractions and cervical dilatation. Mm-hmm. And that is painful because of the muscular contraction that's happening there as well, but also very importantly from the cervical dilatation bit. And that's what transmits pain into the spinal cord through the sort of T10 to L1 routes, through the sympathetic nervous system. I always think it's the most poorly named thing because anything with the sympathetic nervous system is usually pretty crap and not very sympathetic at all.
No.
That's what gives you that distressing, visceral, poorly localised pain of early labour. And thankfully, with the advent of epidurals, we've been able to alleviate that pain for women. Can't always take it away. I mean, to be honest, we can't always take it away, but we can certainly make it much, much better and sometimes remove it entirely. And luckily, those nerves are susceptible to local anaesthetic and opioid, which we can give down an epidural for them. When women come to delivery, however, that's more the second stage of labour. So that's from your full cervical dilatation to the delivery of their infant. That's a different ballgame altogether. And that is more somatic pain. So if you think, guys, about the pain that you treat every day from a trauma, from a surgery, it's more that kind of pain. And that comes through the pudendal nerves. So that's way, way down. It's sacral roots. It's S2 to 4. And that's a very, very different pain. And it's unfortunately not as amenable to epidural. A, intrinsically, those nerves are quite thick and quite difficult for the local anaesthesia to get into. And secondly, you're going to have placed your epidural that little bit higher up on that woman's back. So getting the local down to where that really needs to work is a little bit more difficult. And it's one of the reasons why you'll often hear the story that woman will say, my epidural was great, but it wore off at the end.
Yeah.
It actually didn't wear off at the end. Probably you did your job very, very well, but it's just, it was never, ever going to get the concentration of local down to where it needed to be. And if you think yourself that you're going to place your epidural to try and cope with a low thoracic problem and right down there in a sacral nerve problem, you're going to have to compromise and go somewhere in between, which is why we all go L2, 3, 4. And the hope is that you get high enough and low enough to make it work. I would say to anyone who's thinking about, well, how am I going to manage all of that? I think your priority, in my mind, would have to be that rhythmic pain that's going to go on for quite a long time. So going high enough that you get good cover of those low thoracic roots, I think, is fairly vital. And if there's a brief period of discomfort at the end, then that maybe is just the payback for having had a good epidural for the many hours of labour. But if you do want to specifically target that sacral root pain, intrathecal drugs, spinal drugs are much more effective for that. And it's one of the reasons why I go into a room and a woman is rapidly progressing. She's coming near the end of her labour and I'm thinking, we have a bit of labour to go, but we have delivery coming up. I would be quite keen personally to do a combined spinal epidural for her, because then you get that sacral comfort from the spinal and then you've also got your epidural control.
Yeah. Can I take you back a little bit to, you mentioned CSEs. When I first started obstetrics, I'd only really seen CSEs in the context of, you know, complicated orthopaedic operations or that kind of situation. We're using it a little bit differently here. Would you mind just going through what you find works and what the kind of differences are between that and just a bog standard epidural?
And just for our listeners at home who love abbreviations but aren't sure what they mean, CSE is combined spinal epidural, which is practiced in some units, but regionally some haven't adopted the practice yet.
Definitely, to put it in very, very simple terms, I think, to start with, the difference with doing a spinal along with the epidural is when we do an epidural, we use a large needle and we keep it outside the dural sac. So we don't do a spinal with a big needle. In the situation of doing a CSE, we're going to do the spinal bit because we want that faster onset, because when you do a drug into the CSF, it acts more quickly in a small dose. Bearing back to that physiology again, sorry, the P word, we do get those sacral roots nicely numbed if it's a woman who's coming up quite close to delivery. So what you're doing here is you're putting an epidural in as well and hopefully not puncturing the dura, but as part of that technique, doing a deliberate spinal. And that spinal is exactly what you have done or seen in orthopaedic theatres, you've seen it in general theatres, urology. The technique of spinal is exactly the same, but this way we're doing the two together. We're doing a spinal for fast onset, get it going, an epidural to give us that flexibility and the longevity of the block.
Yeah, and we're using the same mix of bags. We're using 0.1 levobupivacaine. We are not recommending that you use 0.5 in a room where there's just one blood pressure cuff. So I'm sold, okay? I'm going to start buying shares in epidurals, CSEs. Everyone, the partners, the midwives, the coordinators, the obstetrician should have an epidural on board, or do we have other options that we can offer women in pains of labour?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've got a full menu.
Obviously, you're not going to go and start having a conversation about Entonox and aromatherapy with somebody who clearly has exhausted those options already and wants an epidural. But if you get the chance to have conversations with women a bit earlier on, that's really nice, and there's lots of other stuff that we can offer, and there are great information leaflets from the OAA as well.
I have to plug labourpains.org. labourpains.org, everyone, is a brilliant resource for this.
I've used it loads, especially the translated leaflets. I find really, really helpful.
So if we take a step back then, because that might be a good place to start for when thinking about it, you are seeing a woman in your obstetric high risk clinic and they want to talk through their pain management options. What would you be able to say to them?
I really think that the whole point of this is that there is a menu to choose from. You're not coming to Nando's and it just has to be chicken. There's a wide variety of what we can offer women. And
delicious analogy.
And nothing wrong with Nando's, by the way, and other chicken outlets are available.
Extra discount doesn't bother.
It's all about that individual nature of obstetric anaesthesia, because this experience is going to be a singularly unique experience for each woman, particularly if it's a first-time mum. So she has no past experience of labour to relate to, and sitting as a guy in his 50s, I have absolutely no experience to relate to. So we're going to have to open the door to all possibilities. I think you have to mention to them the non-pharmacological options they can utilise as well. I would only briefly mention those. They're not my expertise, and midwives will talk much more about those. But you don't have to have drugs for everything. TENS machines are used, so you can do that little bit of transcutaneous electrical current.
These are just packs that give a electrical shock therapy?
A little transcutaneous electrical current.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds a lot nicer than an electrical shock.
I think I wouldn't call it shock therapy. Oh, no. and certainly these kind of non-pharmacological things, some women just want that.
Yeah.
And that's what this is all about. It's a conversation. And secondly, the early stages of labour are much more amenable to things that psychologically help in that way. And the psychology of labour is a major part of this whole thing. Never underestimate, no matter what the effect of the drug is, that element of control is really important. But most of those non-pharmacological methods will be better described by midwifery staff, in fairness, and they will be mainly for very early stages of labour. I would consider those more like the snacks that you're having before your main meal. They're not going to fill you, but they'll do the trick for a while.
Question that you don't have to answer. Back injections, do you do them in your unit? Do you have a thought?
I have a little piece of paper here where I have saline injections, don't start me, exclamation mark, nice guidance, 4 exclamation marks, and no with 8 O's. So I'm sorry, don't know how that got into nice guidance, and no is the short answer.
But this is really useful because coming into these situations with when you don't have a lot of experience, even when you do have a lot of experience actually, lots of women will come with preconceptions and ideas, and this might be something that they've read, and then we have to address it and have a conversation with them and try and come to an agreement between all of us. And I think that can be really tricky, and I don't know if you've got any tips on how to navigate that.
I think that principle you've described there applies every day on labour ward.
Yeah.
So it's not limited
specific
to saline injections. I'm not trained to do them. That would be my get out of jail free card. Women make their decision for their labour. And what our job is to safely provide, within the remit of our expertise, what will work for them and what is supportive for them. And I think if they want to go down the route of a technique that you and I don't think is particularly efficacious, who are we to say they can't do it? As I've pointed out at talks I've given before, married guy, 2 grown-up daughters. I've learned a long time ago, you don't tell women what they want and what they think. That is a life-shortening philosophy for any guy out there. What you do is you don't do something you don't think is right.
Yeah.
But if something's just not efficacious and they want to do it, if they want to have aromatherapy and whale music in the room, that's absolutely fine. I'll be outside with the epidural trolley when they find that that's not enough.
Yeah.
Most women will move on to something pharmacological, and that's going to be either something systemic, so it's something you're going to take in as inhaled nitrous oxide in an oxygen mix, or you're going to take some opioids, morphine, dimorphine, remifentanil, those kinds of things, and they're going to act by alleviating the pain at your brain level. So the bottom line is there's a downside to that. There's a downside to everything. And the downside is that you're going to alter how that woman feels. There are issues with nausea, with a bit of sedation and so on that can happen with those. But lots of women choose that.
It's interesting we use pethidine, which we never really use anywhere else, morphine and dimorphine. But they can only have one of those injections, can't they? Because it's been shown that although it doesn't affect the maternal fetal outcomes, it does make the baby, what we quote, a little sleepier, right?
In terms of systemic opioids, even though we all want to sit there with our epidural needles, we want to do things that we know are very effective, that we as anaesthetists can provide for women in labour. Many, many women don't want an epidural or have an idea that they're scared about having it. Or for some women can't have, a previous spine surgery, coagulopathy, anticoagulant therapies. So there are lots of reasons why some women can't have an epidural as well. So for that population, we do have to have an answer for that. And current answers are not brilliant. And you're right about the fetal effects, particularly with pethidine. And it's amazing, if you look at a drug that has been around since the 50s, the first research produced that showed it wasn't that good as an analgesic and wasn't great for babies was produced within a decade. So we've had papers since the 60s and 70s telling us that pethidine really isn't a great analgesic and it's not a great choice for labour, but it's still being used. And the problem is that it's finding alternatives that are better, and certainly dimorphine is better, much better. It's better pain relief for mums, and that's been shown. But also, just because of its pharmacology, that's another P word, just because of its pharmacology is less likely to get trapped into the fetus, because the fetus is slightly more acidotic than the mum, and that means that some drugs will just get into the baby and then not get back out again as easily. And pethidine's a horrible one for that. Dimorphine, morphine, a bit less so, but they all get into the baby. I would have to put the stall out there for remifentanil, which we use quite a bit of in the hospital that I work in. And then thinking in terms of the core bread and butter stuff that we do as anaesthetists, we would obviously want to let the women know about the regional techniques that we can provide for them, which would be your epidurals, spinals in some small instances, and the combination of both in that CSE. I always have as my mantra, you need to be honest with women, you need to tell them the information that matters to them. It's a conversation, it's not a lecture, but I do have at the back of my mind that you're sharing, not scaring, if at all possible, because it's a frightening prospect coming into labour, especially for first-time mums. And if they're attending your high-risk clinic, there's something else there as well. So you want to make sure that you reassure that you will provide them with what is feasibly good to do,
yeah,
and that you will support them in their choice of what they want. But they have to have the whole menu to make that choice.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point.
And then we've got the pharmacological things that you were talking about systemically. So nitrous oxide, where the pros are that it's fast onset, it can make you feel a little bit lightheaded. Negatives are that people don't use it during their surges or contractions. Otherwise, they will get lightheaded, feel sick and nauseous. And often they have been using the Entonox for a while, because when you come in, they're feeling nauseated. It's very nauseous means that you make everyone else in the room feel sick, which, yeah, very interesting.
Does that happen when you go into the room?
Everyone says, I feel, make them feel nauseous.
At Mediplus, we've been working alongside anaesthetists for over 20 years, developing innovative devices you use every day, when high flow is key. Our collaboration has delivered the successful peripheral IV Coventry connector. It's a trusted favourite in delivery suites worldwide. Don't take our word for it. Talk to your colleagues and discover the Mediplus difference. Visit us at www.mediplusuk.com to learn more.
If you were to explain to us how you consent someone for an epidural, or even say what an epidural is, what is it?
Well, I think we should start with just what it is, because when you're going to go in and consent this woman for an epidural, you have to have clear in your head exactly what, in practical physical terms, you're about to do, and then talk about the relevance of that and its complications and what effects it will have. So what you're trying to do is get local anaesthetic directly into the epidural space. So that's not as far in as a spinal, but a reasonable depth in under the skin. So you're going to go in between 4 and 6 centimetres in most women. To give you the longevity of your epidural technique, you're going to have to leave something in there to give the local downness. So we leave a little fine, floppy plastic tube, is how I describe it to the women. And that will be left in her back, so the needle will come out. So always reassure them there's nothing sharp left in their back. It's just little bit of plastic, they can move about, nothing's going to happen, they can rub their back against the bed, they can get up to sit, walk about, whatever they want to do. So obviously you want to make sure that that doesn't go where you don't want it to go. But the downside of having to leave a thin tube, plastic tube in, is of course the needle itself has to be a reasonable size of needle. So you imagine that it's much bigger than your average cannula, and in fact it would be an 18 or 16 gauge in front. The drugs then have to go down that epidural catheter. And so that will take you a little while to give test dose, a full dose, and then it takes a little bit of time for those drugs to get right in to the spinal nerves. So from the time you get an epidural in until it's working fully, depends a little bit on the drugs you choose, but by and large, I would say to any woman, 20 to 30 minutes minimum, but she will feel some benefit a bit sooner, but it's really about half an hour until she's got the full effect.
How do you consent people for this? I know there's guidance online from various organisations of what you should say, but it's different than how you say it, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. I take the complications information, and in fact, all the positives as well in information epidurals from the OAA Labour Pains website. It's absolutely fab. And the good thing about that website, if you are signposting women to it, is that it's written in really good but correct lay language.
Yeah.
And also you do have lots of language options there as well. So if you're working with a population where they are not native English speaking, I always feel that information like this, it's fine if English is your second language and you're okay to order a pint in the bar. That's not quite the same thing as making a decision about someone putting epidural in your back. I'm a very firm advocate for translation for women for services in labour, unless they have a really, really good grasp of English. So my basis would be the OAA, signposting them to their own native language. For that, I have to say that, not just because I'm on the committee, although it does help. And then you have to have the conversation with this woman. And over the years, you learn, I think, how to have that conversation. And everyone has it in a different way. And the great thing about being a junior anaesthetist is that you get to hear everyone else's comment.
Yeah, I think mine's made up of snippets of phrases from lots of different anaesthetists.
Totally. It's like every anaesthetic technique, you all do different things. I have a particular way of anaesthetising children. It's an amalgam of different people's work.
Like a cheese board.
Not the cheese board. I'm never going to use the cheese board. But certainly everyone will have their own way. And you, as a junior anaesthetist, soak up everything that you hear from other people. And you learn from absolutely everybody. Some people you learn, yeah, I'm going to do it that way. Other people you learn, hell, I will never do it that way. That's all learning. It's all learning both ways.
And then the next thing I wanted to ask you about was, okay, you put your epidural in, you were happy, everything looked good, you've gone to sit down, you're writing it down, you're feeling happy with yourself. Bleep goes again. It's not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
The disappointment washes over you.
Yeah.
How do you approach it?
Well, it's quite funny. I was sort of thinking, when you look at an epidural that's not working perfectly, I think it falls into a triage, literally a triage, sort of three categories. A bit like the Ellie Taylor program, Snog, Marry, Avoid.
Which we're not encouraging.
We're not encouraging any of that at all, absolutely. But it's more, I think it's fix, recite or abandon. And okay. I think that's really what it falls into. So you're looking at an epidural. You walk into the room and you go, first and foremost is, what level of pain is this woman in and where is she feeling the pain? And simply reassure her. This isn't what we said would happen. This doesn't appear to be working fully, but there's something we can do about it. I think that's so important at any stage in obstetric anaesthesia,
yeah,
that you reassure that you have a plan.
We're going to sort this out.
We're going to sort this out. It's just not maybe the plan we originally had that's going to work. So you go in and you start thinking, well, can I fix this epidural? That's the first category. If you look and the epidural is a low level bilaterally, always check the level again when you're called in to troubleshoot. So whether you're using ice or evac fluid, whatever you're using, test where that level is. So if you've got a low level that's your T11, T12 on both sides, you go, well, we've got a block. It's both sides. That's fixable. So all I need to do is give some local anaesthesia into it, push that epidural up. That's a very fixable one. And you can, again, choose either to use low concentration, high volume under the pump. I think in this situation, I would go for something maybe a little bit more concentrated to just get on top of this pain quickly. Mm-hmm. If it's patchy, so you have a level that's good enough, but there is an area below the upper limit of numbness that is still sore, that's euphemistically called a missed segment, but it's actually pretty awful for the woman. Again, that is fixable. Not always, but usually fixable. And what I would do is I would get her to lie on the side that's not as numb, give some local anaesthesia down the catheter, and then I would also give some opioid, because that kind of missed segment is usually more susceptible to a bit of opioid.
Okay.
However, if I go into the room and it's never worked, she has no discernible block, then you've got to say, right, well, I think this is a reset. I think sometimes we persist when we really don't need to. My view in that setting is, I would simply say, look, we talked about failures and a complication of an epidural insertion. So I think we're looking at, we need to do this again.
Yeah.
And it becomes a choice for that woman herself. Does she want to have the whole process done again? In my experience, almost all women are happy to have the epidural recited.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't normally abandon at that stage. I would do a second technique. You know what? Because epidural catheters can just lie a little bit differently when you put them in, a second will frequently work very well.
Yeah.
If she's very sore at that point, I might then do my CSE. I might say, right, let's just get spinal in here, get you comfy,
yeah,
then we'll do the epidural.
Because some significant amount of time has probably passed since you first requested the epidural, right?
And I think that's just, you are increasing slightly the risk of headache, I suppose, because you're doing a dural puncture. But in reality, with a lovely small spinal needle, that risk is very, very low in labour. And I think most women are very amenable to that. And I think that builds that trust back up again, which potentially is a little bit under threat here.
Yeah.
And also helps you, because you then got a comfortable woman to do your epidural on. If we've recited already and it's not working, or we've just decided that this is, she doesn't want us, right? Doesn't want us to recite, then I think you do have to have a plan B, C, D, E. And we're all used with that in anaesthesia. And for me, my plan under that circumstance would be remifentanil PCA.
Yeah.
and we use it a lot in our unit, and it's a really good get out of jail free card. It means that this woman's now going down the systemic opioid route, yeah, which maybe was not what she planned initially, but you have to do the best you can to provide some form of analgesia for this woman, even if neuraxia, epidural analgesia, is not going to be an option for her. And yeah, we use remifentanil very, very routinely. I think to tell a woman that you're moving from a planned epidural to just a shot of pethidine morphine is a bit savage. It's a bit savage. You're taking her out of that lovely stretch limo and you're putting her into a much, much less luxurious vehicle.
I didn't know what you were going to pick.
You know what I mean? No, you know what I mean? It's just, it's, don't want to be down on any particular form of automobile.
Criticizing of
You know, you're having to manage expectations on that as well. But I think we can reassure women that we can get something which will control their pain relief. And most troubleshooting works very well. And can I just say, the vast majority will be managed neuraxially. You will find a plan that works.
We've got some very good supplementary material, which is linked to the episode, with some very, very good detail on actually how you are supposed to test epidurals and spinals to check that they're working properly, and also how to troubleshoot them. That information is available underneath the episode description.
Attention anaesthetists. Are you looking for a more efficient way to manage your medical rotas and clinical allocations? Are you on a hospital rota and wish it was easier and quicker to manage your own shifts? Introducing Hospital, the rostering platform designed by anaesthetists for medical professionals like you. With Hospital, you can track your shifts, manage leave, and make changes. As an administrator, you can significantly reduce the effort to build rosters and keep them up to date, all in real time from any device. It's seamless, reliable, and tailored to the unique demands of medical teams. With 15 years of experience in anaesthesia in Australia and suitable for hospitals all over the world, Hospital streamlines your work so you can focus on providing exceptional care. Join thousands of healthcare professionals who trust Hospital to simplify their scheduling. Visit hospital.com today to learn more and arrange a demonstration. That's hosportal.com. Hospital, professional scheduling made simple.
Epidural's a tick, right? Sign, seal, delivered. We've got the tattoos. We've signed up to the emailing list. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. But you were also mentioning that we should also get some shares in remifentanil PCAs. Why?
Well, Remy is just a really, really good option on labour ward for women who don't want or can't have an epidural. You have to bear in mind, we don't live in North America. We're not sitting here with like 90% of our women having epidurals. Lots and lots of women, for their own reasons, varied reasons, will choose they don't want an epidural. And also, we do have those women with back surgery, coagulopathies, other reasons that we just might not feel it's the safest, best option for them. So you need to have an alternative. There will always be a place for systemic opioid analgesia in labour. It's just a question of which is the least worst option of that, in a sense. And my view would be that remifentanil fits that bill. I talked to lots of people about remifentanil. Our unit was one of the first to use it, and we are one of the bigger users within the UK of remifentanil. We've offered it routinely now for 20 years. Despite what anyone else tells you guys, whoever's listening, it's not that dangerous, because there are going to be people going to tell you that it's like stabbing people in the street or something, and it patently is not. But the thing about it is, I wouldn't choose it. It wouldn't be what I would want in a painful situation like that. But that's not the point. It's that menu we talked about earlier. It's what does that woman want in her labour. And remifentanil, out of the opioids, it's a very, very short-acting opioid. Literally within about 30 seconds, they're starting to feel the benefits of it. Within about 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it's out of the system again. In reality, it's an ideal option if you want to try it and see if it works for you with the rhythmic pain of labour. It doesn't tally with the labour contractions. I mean, anyone tells you that the times with the contractions is, again, talking nonsense. But it does at least give you the control element, which we've talked about before, about how women having control over their choice. So I think it's very like why women will use Entonox very effectively. It's rapid on, rapid off, and I choose when I want to use it. And likewise, remifentanil fits that bill. It's just more effective.
So I have a confession, which is that I've only managed to facilitate a remifentanil PCA on a very small number of occasions. And what I've come up against as a kind of barrier has been midwife training and staffing.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about like the safety and that side of things.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to bear in mind that you are using a potent opioid. You're using it in a patient controlled system. So you don't control how much this woman gets. She controls it. And then we have to build that into the glorious chaos that we already alluded to as labour ward. And so it's really, really important that primum non nocere, first do no harm. And we all know that. So we have a very safe system built up in our unit, and other units have done similar. And that is that you really, really must have a continuous presence of a midwife with this woman. So you have to have one-to-one care. And I know that's a real sticking point for some units. You might work in a unit where that is just not feasible. And if it's not feasible, then you cannot offer remifentanil. That midwife also needs to have been trained in looking after women who have remifentanil. You also have to monitor the women closely. So it's one of those reasons you can imagine that when our midwifery led unit came and said, oh, can we use remifentanil? And the answer was absolutely not. This is a labour ward method of analgesia, and it's full labour ward monitoring. So our women don't actually have to have a continuous CTG, but the vast majority do. Yeah. But apart from that, they must have continuous SATS monitoring. And they must have all the other non-invasive blood pressure, etc., done during their labour. So they have to be prepared for that. Mm-hmm. We also use a dedicated cannula. When you look at the case reports, I'm sitting at the moment starting to do the literature search for the remifentanil budget with the OAA, which hopefully you'll all hear loads about next year. Looking at that, some of the case reports where there have been serious adverse incidents, and I'm not going to underplay that, some of those have been where remifentanil was in a drip that was being shared with other fluids, etc. So okay. Dedicated cannula really is important here. And of course, only the women push the PCA button. That's a principle for all PCAs, as you know. And obviously have the availability of nasal specs oxygen, because a fair number of women, anywhere between about 30 and 50% of women, will have a dip in their oxygen saturation at some point below 94%, which is usually our safe threshold. And we would suggest that if that's anything more than a very transient dip, we would give supplementary oxygen. So you need to have that all in. But with that in place, remifentanil is a safe option that can be provided. And speaking as an anaesthetist in a unit where we have routinely offered it for over 20 years, it is a popular choice. So I think we would be that awful server person who came out and said to you that your lovely venison that you were just about to order isn't on the menu. You're taking a thing off the menu. And I think we should be trying, with safety in mind, we should be expanding the menu for women. And there's a very good editorial from Carolyn Weiniger in NIJOA a few years ago talking about remifentanil on the a la carte menu. And I love that analogy. I think it's something you should offer, and it's up to women to choose it if they wish, and it's up to you to safely provide it.
And you can tell that this is a morning recording session, because all we've talked about is food.
Yeah, that is very
for
true.
The entire
that is very true. And I hope most of the food analogies have been quite nice, apart from the cheese.
Yeah. Gone from Nando's, them cheese boards, and now we're back on to venison, which is slightly confusing. Is there anyone that you wouldn't use a remifentanil infusion in? Obviously, people who refuse it, right?
Yeah, well, obviously, contraindications are lack of consent, so the woman doesn't consent to having it. And I've never come across a true allergy to remifentanil, but obviously that would be another contraindication. There are no other real contraindications, but there would be cautions. One of the things, if you have extremes of BMI, so very low BMI women, we would reduce our dose in those women, but otherwise leave it the same. High BMI, just to be a bit cautious. I mean, think about your general anaesthesia cases, guys, anywhere else where you're at risk of obstructive sleep apnea and so on happening. That is where I feel actually our fixed bolus, we normally give a 40 microgram bolus with a 2 minute lockout. That's where the fixed bolus actually helps us, because that turns out to be relatively underdosing for larger women. But in all of our audits, we have found, although those women were a bit more likely to require supplementary oxygen in terms of nasal specs, there was no greater difference, no real difference in higher BMI women ending up having to have the remifentanil taken away. And that's one of the things to say, is if they don't respond adequately to nasal specs oxygen, just take it away. And the wonderful thing about remifentanil is 2 minutes later, it's nowhere. So we didn't find that high BMI women were detrimentally affected in that sense. They were no more likely to have it taken away, but they were slightly more likely to need supplementary oxygen. But I think being a bit more cautious in those high BMI women would be important. I also feel any woman who has a CTG abnormality before you walk into the room. All of us who've done obstetric anaesthesia know that opioids and CTGs have a variable relationship. Certainly, I find that IV Remi in a not ideal CTG just makes the CTG worse. And I think it's part of the potency thing. But no, I wouldn't give it to women who have CTG abnormalities. I also think if you're walking into a room and the stars are lining up, like this looks like this could be a theatre case,
yeah.
as opposed to a labour case anymore, I think rather than muddying the waters with Remi PCA, I would get the obstetric colleagues in and have an assessment. Where are we going here?
That leads us quite nicely into what we were just going to end on, which is pain in a cesarean section, which is a huge topic. And there are some wonderful, wonderful best practice guidelines which have come out about this, which I would really encourage people to read. And they will be linked at the bottom of the episode. What are your thoughts? What would your tips be for people encountering these women if they say that they're a bit uncomfortable during a cesarean section?
Well, the first thing is, guys, be reassured. Every obstetric anaesthetist on the planet has faced this. So this is not some sort of personal failure. This is terrible. How did this happen to me? What did I do wrong? This just happens. If it's happening every day in your labour ward, like, do come and talk to your education. But as an isolated event, this happens to absolutely everyone. And you're right, there are great guidelines. They were published, I think, in anaesthesia. But the wonderful Dr. Felicity Platt led from the OAA on that. So certainly read up on those guidelines. I think the first thing about it is accept the fact this woman is sore. Reassure her, believe her, and acknowledge what's happening. That's the first thing you have to do. First of all, that allows her to feel that she can trust you, that you've got a plan. And then you make your plan from that point onwards, okay? Calling for help at this point is, of course, a very good thing to do, particularly if you're a novice, because whoever you call will have met this before. It's not a rarity. And then you decide, right, what's my next plan? So if it has happened right at the start of surgery, so if this is literally they haven't even done skin, they've done the pinch testing, and this woman is sore, been there, done that, or they've just literally started and the woman is sore, well, then you can literally just stop. So the first thing you do is you say, I'm really sorry you experienced that. Ask her what it felt like. And I'm going to say to you that if anyone is feeling pain or discomfort at that stage in the surgery, you will never get through that operation comfortably for that woman without changing tack. There's a new plan here. But the good thing is, always think of the good side, you haven't gone past the point of no return. So you can do a second neuraxial procedure here. So you can sit this woman up again, you can do a second spinal. My colleagues in the Ulster would obviously say, yeah, he's going to say CSE, and yeah, I'm going to say CSE. So the thing is, you would sit her up, and in case this is an issue, that spinal isn't just going to be the optimal technique for this woman, or you've already got a bit of a block that looked high enough and you're concerned about another full spinal, so you could sit her up and do another combined spinal epidural technique, and then start from fresh. And this is all assuming, obviously, that the urgency of cesarean allows you to do this, but it does mean she can have what she wanted, which is be awake and be comfortable. If you are doing that, you might reduce your dose of spinal local anaesthesia. You probably wouldn't repeat your intrathecal, your spinal opioid. And plug here for my favourite drugs, down epidurals, ropivacaine 0.75. It is the boil to top up a CSE. Fabulous drug. And don't be thinking in terms of how long it takes epidurals to work in any other setting. In the setting of having had a spinal and then you're augmenting that with an epidural, works really quickly, works really well. It works quickly enough to keep an angry obstetrician at bay. It's totally fine. And my other drug of choice down the epidural, which again is a bit rogue, is some alfentanil. Alfentanil is an absolutely fab drug. Has a bit of sodium channel blockade. It's a low potency drug, you give a high amount of it, so the onset's quick. Lovely, lovely drug. So if you give a bit of ropivacaine, 500 mg of alfentanil, magic. And just wait for it to work. Let it work and see if that's okay. Always, always have the back of your mind, have the idea that you might have to go to sleep. And I think one of the things when we look at pain occurring a bit later in the cesarean section, so we've started the operating, always offer a general anaesthetic if that is what the woman would prefer to have. Even if you don't want to do it, really important that you offer it and you document that you offered it. You'd ask the surgeons to stop. So this is later in the C-section. The one time they have to proceed, guys, and it's only one time, is if they've done the uterine incision and baby's not out yet. At that point, you really just reassure, and get your surgeon to just very, very quickly deliver the baby. Then you regroup, because there really isn't time to do anything different at that point for the baby's well-being. But once you've got baby out, they can stop. You ask the woman where she's feeling the pain, how severe the pain is, and then you make your plan. So what do you do? Well, you must give additional analgesia. And I say, regardless of what your next plan is, something intravenous of an opioid nature is what you should be doing. If you had a combined spinal epidural on board, as I might have had, say, if I'd anticipated a difficult cesarean section here, start using your bupivacaine to top that up. I personally don't go any further in terms of intravenous augmentation apart from some intravenous alfentanil or fentanyl. Mm-hmm. But other colleagues do sometimes use a little bit of ketamine. You could give 10 milligram bonuses of that. I'm not a huge fan of that. And while you're buying time, of course, the woman can still use nitrous oxide, because you're at your lovely anaesthesia machine where you can do that.
Yeah, that's a really good one not to forget, actually, yeah. That you can just deliver nitrous in a 50-50 mix from the anaesthetic.
Totally. And also, this becomes a team decision as well. Remember, as I've said all along with this, this is a conversation and a collaboration. So you're chatting to the woman, what she's feeling, what she's not feeling. If they stop surgery and she becomes comfortable, that encourages me that we can do something, either using an in situ epidural or using something intravenous that could help. Whereas if she's sore, even when they're not operating anymore, then I think really you're talking general anaesthesia. And despite all your best efforts, this might be where you're going. But it is a conversation. We've all been there, where a woman you really feel should have a GA doesn't want a GA. And that's a difficult one, guys. That's a very difficult one. And I wouldn't expect a novice anaesthetist to be making the call on this. We've all been there. And I think all you can do is reassure her that you will give something else in the meantime. But yeah. Point out, we might end up with a general anaesthetic, and document. And I think one of the big things is, don't be afraid to deliver a general anaesthetic. I sometimes feel in obstetrics, we're so bloody good at regional. We are the kings of regional. And it's such a lovely experience for the women to have a cesarean section under regional, hold their baby, have a birthing partner there, it's all lovely. That we sort of see general anaesthesia as a complete failure, and we don't do it very often. I think we have to understand that you can safely do it. And some people panic a little bit as trainees about the GA for the woman in labour, but on the previous night shift, they did that 160-kilo laparotomy and thankfully didn't call me in at all. I was in my bed. And they don't seem to marry the two things up. We can give GAs in maternity, and always be assured you must do what's right for that woman. She needs a comfortable experience, because the psychological trauma of a poorly managed painful cesarean section is all too clear to be seen in anyone who's met a woman coming for a subsequent delivery.
Yeah.
We've all seen that. And there's a fantastic on YouTube, Susanna Stanford, who has a practice-changing story that I think you all should listen to. It certainly has changed how I do my practice, and is a brilliant consumer's side, but also letting you know what the implications down the line can be for these women. So any woman who's had any pain under cesarean, even if you've managed it really well, I think it's really important that you give them a debrief, that they get spoken to by the whole team, and have a chance to discuss how it was for them, possibly even giving them a subsequent clinic appointment if you have the luxury of that in your unit, which we're only setting up actually in ours. And always believe what they said, because this is their experience. And the final point is that absolutely, you don't treat pain with anxiolytics. So you don't give just midazolam to this woman. That is so inappropriate, and is only going to add to the trauma. You are the anaesthetist magician. You have a box of tricks, and you use the appropriate thing out of that.
And just on that point, for anaesthetists, this is the highest source of litigation because of the trauma that you're speaking about. But it is important from our point of view to document what they have experienced, when they have experienced, and what you've offered. And not just once I've offered a GA at fentanyl at this time. Revisit these conversations, because you want to make sure there is a timeline of what's been offered, and that you've been doing the appropriate things in your box of tricks for that person in front of you as well.
Totally. And you know what? As with all areas of anaesthesia, things will always go wrong. And that's actually not the crux of the thing. It's how you manage the thing that went wrong.
Yeah.
And you and I know that we've had thank you cards and everything from women who had epidurals that really weren't our best epidurals. And often that's just because of how you delivered the care, which is wider than the pain relief. And I think that's why it's so crucial to learn at the hands of older, sometimes wiser people, sometimes not wise people.
Yeah, sometimes definitely not wise, Damien. Not a reflection on you, just some
company included.
Yeah.
But it's just to learn how to manage that.
Yeah.
And manage how those difficult conversations, because those situations have very big impacts.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been gold. Do you have any top tips for our novices starting on labour ward, or anything that you have found particularly useful over the years? I mean, I feel like it's all in the episode anyway, but is there any kind of final thing to leave on it?
The point I would leave everybody with is, because I love obstetric anaesthesia, so the point I would leave you with is, it is a wonderful job and a wonderful part of anaesthesia. And when you go into a woman who's really distressed in labour and you do a lovely, lovely regional technique and you walk in 20 minutes later and she is just having a very, very different day, that's just a phenomenal thing to do. It really is. It's a lovely, lovely thing. And as we said earlier, the privilege of being at someone's C-section or delivery at a really important moment in their lives, absolutely fantastic. Worth its weight in gold, and almost makes up for the night shifts.
TBC on that one.
My sort of mantra at work is every day is a school day, and you always learn something new on labour ward every day. So be open to learning new things. Be open to learning new things. And particularly when you're a trainee, you get to work with everybody. So you just pick the things you like. As I said before, you learn from everybody. Sometimes you learn, oh, I love to do that thing. And then other times you learn, I will never do that thing. But every day is a school day. And don't be afraid to ask questions, because people like me will bend your ear and talk for hours and tell you it. And love obstetric anaesthesia. It's great.
Thank you.
What a nice way to it. I feel warm and fuzzy. We've gone from Nando's to cheese balls to venison. Thank you for coming, Damien.
Thank you, Damien.
Hello and welcome to the end of the episode. A big thank you to Damien for making labour pains not so painful as a topic to go over. As ever, we have some outros to look at, including the testing guidelines for epidurals, a epidural troubleshoot guide from East Anglia, pain during cesarean section guide that we'd spoken about. We then have the OAA website labour pains that we looked at for consent, and then there were some articles that Damien discussed. So, Owen, what's this wonderful cheese analogy that you're talking about? Well, as ever, it's not actually my analogy. I've stolen it off Dr. Williamson, so thank you very much. Anyway, what they were saying is that you can equate the layers you go through to get to the epidural space as a cheese board. So going through skin and fat is a bit like going through brie, then supraspinous is a bit like going through some Edam or mature cheddar. Then interspinous would be sort of a weaker, milder cheddar that you might get a big block of Tesco. Then you're going to reach the ligaments flavium, which would be a bit like Parmesan crunching through. And then the epidural space is a bit like going into burrata. Anyway, I hope that doesn't put you off cheese. As ever, we should mention that the opinions and suggestions here are exactly that of mine, Rosie's and Damien's, and that there will be a variation of practice within the UK, and please do consult with your seniors about what to do during specific circumstances. In the pain during cesarean section discussion, Damien refers to Susanna Stanford, a patient advocate who experienced pain during her cesarean section and has gone on to give international talks. We very luckily managed to get her in the podcast studio, and she will be featuring one of our upcoming episodes. about pain during cesarean section, the patient's experience. I've got a fantastic episode coming up next. It is a rematch for the ages, myself versus Rahul Bandyopadhyay from season one, about all the drugs that go on in maternity wards. And as ever, we take on a game show element, and there's a prize of a golden Tui needle. So I will see you at the next episode. Bye-bye for now.